I'd like to start all of this off by thanking the museum so much, sharing some of my series with so many scholars and experts and artists and students is a true honor. So I've been invited to to share two projects with you today, and I'll get back to what you're seeing on the screen right now. Since I was a child, I've always been passionate about trying to see humanity from different angles. By that I mean being curious about asking the right type of questions, more so than hearing the correct answers from the society around me. During the past 20 years, I've explored the relationship between nature and culture through photography and filmmaking. I soon found creative tools to help me share my curiosity, and ever since I've been on a fantastic journey. My projects really look at the theme of the nature and culture relation from many different sides. I've been working a lot with the human body in relation to media, the concept of death and dying in different cultures. I've been working with evolution and the fact that we have an urge to collect and put nature into some kind of system, and also ourselves, obviously. Communities which are based upon natural resources have interested me a lot. Technology and nature, which I'll be sharing after, and the wolf, as you can see here. So in this project, the audience is really invited to look at the raw nature and purity which the wolf represents, and how this reflects the condition of man and his own shadows materialized as more or less taboos in society. So I don't want to bombard you with information, but I do want to try to invite you into yourselves, into the nature which you're also born as, and in that, possibly also hidden opportunities. So let's see. I'll go a little bit back and forth with the images. I was invited by a researcher in 2010 to meet several individuals, a wolf pack in Norway. And ever since, I've been very, very fascinated by these individuals. And also how I experienced the nature in me. The series is called Shadow Within, and I was quite sure I was going to try to find some of the shadows of the wolf, and instead it was really my shadows that I was exploring. I found that out just after the first meeting. So with saying this also, you know, I'm not the wolf man, and I haven't been living with these wolves. They have been very physical. I've needed to do language courses and security courses. So even though these are partly socialized animals, they are not tame. And I always have two people with me who know them very well, so they can distract a situation, because they are curious, just like children, but they're also very fearful, and they're quite big animals. So if they get stressed out, it's gonna affect you somehow. There are a lot of misunderstandings also with this relationship, which I'll come back to. So the shadows and the taboos that that I want to look closer at and invite you into are really, it's mainly fear, which they rely upon 100%. The reason the wolf is still alive is because of this fear. It's also aggression, social hierarchy, which in humans come in so many different levels we don't talk about, sexuality, and loneliness, just to name a few. So let me go on here and see. I started coming back to these individuals and also the group dynamics of the wolf, and seeing really the personalities, which are very similar to humans. They're as different individually as humans. There is bullying in the social structure. There's a lot of love, the loneliness really reminds me of humans. It is group dynamics, and they all want to be part of something, but they're also scared to be alone. And the worst thing that could happen, obviously, would be to push out of this group. And I think that goes very much for humans as well, because we want to be part of something. It's very interesting studying these animals. I'm not a researcher, I'm not a scientist, but really trying to explore myself in meeting these amazing allure animals. I see myself in the situation shown in all of the images. And I think partly in an art project like this, for me, going out of my own comfort zone is very important to be able to invite the viewer in, out of their own. I've needed to let go of preconceptions and control, as the wolf cannot be empowered. And this is very much, I think, what brings fear into man and his relationship to nature. We as humans are compelled to harness, control, and systemize nature to feel dominant and safe somehow. And it was really not until man acquired livestock and fences that the wolf became a threat in Norway as it is today. Politically, it's also a huge problem, because the wolf represents raw nature. It's also that animal that cannot be controlled, and this is a huge problem. So in Sweden, they've even spoken about just killing off the whole animal, because it is kind of in the way. We let animals out for pasture in the forests and in the mountains, and sometimes the wolf obviously kills and eats some of those. And that is a huge problem. So we tend to forget really the balance of things. Talking about balance, it's also important to see the wolf as an important piece of the puzzle in ecology. So can this really tell us something about a larger picture in our own relationship to nature and culture? Many of the images become unassailable. The instinct of the viewer will automatically and naturally interpret the situation she or he might be in when looking at the body language and eyes of the wolf. And what's coming in that would be our own instinct. And talking about instinct, I think it's interesting to bring some of the psychology in. Freud was obsessed about the id in us. The id is really before the ego and before the superego. The id is before teachers and schools and religion. It's what really drives man. It's what also has to do very much with evolution. And that's fear and sexuality. So we can talk about how much fear the wolf has in survival, but man also has that. They say that 80% of all of our judgments or decision-making is based upon fear. So then I think it's interesting to look at what that fear is in our individual lives. So they also say 75% of all human communication is nonverbal. Does that mean that verbal language can actually get in the way of our communication sometimes? This is a good example of the social hierarchy part. I can see human relations in this. But it's important that people do have their own associations. And then you have the whole idea of childhood. Everything we've been growing up with folklore. In Norway, there's a lot of folklore. And I know you also have a lot of amazing history in fairy tales. And fairy tales in the olden days had to do with moral, which is very much gone in the day we live in, I think. So, very much different language from the wolves. And I've been using a bear den, this is not a wolf's den, as metaphors for the inner and the outer. I've also been looking for cracks and holes in the landscape, and really tried not to make any pretty portraits of the wolves, to get my point across here. And the allureness, the mythical animal, which we often are very much afraid of, but also fascinated by. Maybe because we partly can see ourselves. You know, a lot of people talk about the wolf energy as a macho thing, but it's not really macho at all. It has just as much to do with the feminine, with the group dynamics, with embracing, with taking care of the flock. And it's interesting looking at the dynamics of the group, where a true secure leadership will see the different individuals, both their strengths and their weaknesses. The wolf has nothing, extra flab. It's the perfect predator. It cannot have many faults. They communicate three or four times what they're trying to say to each other, so as not to misunderstand. So evolution has really done a great job in that. A true leadership will see, for example, small strengths in the weakest individuals in the family as well, because it is a family group. So, for example, one may not be able to communicate very well, but has a fantastic nose for hunting. And when they do hunt, that leadership will, which is often a male and a female, will let that weaker wolf with the nose lead the pack to find animals. And that weaker individual will also feel that it really is in this group, and they really need that wolf to be stronger. And I think that says something about us as well in wanting to be part of something, being needed in society or a family or a friendship or a group. So we have very strong social structures. And as I said, we base a lot of our lives upon fear. In the constant stream of information we live in, nothing is anymore really hidden or unfamiliar, yet the experience of entering the wolf's territory demands an informational condensation unknown to daily thinking. What Einstein praised as the zenith of life, the mysterious. So I think it's interesting looking at how the wolf has been mystified through politics and folklore. There are a lot of misinterpretations from childhood, and seeing this animal as the devil's beast. So I can just mention I'm also working on another project from the 1600s in Norway with a ritual, very dark rituals of man and how to keep this devil's beast away in the name of Christianity. And this was a period where they went from being agnostic to Christian. So there are a lot of quite heavy rituals with purifications, how to hunt this animal. And again, when we acquired livestock and fences, that all changed very much. Before that, the wolf was seen as the perfect predator, the perfect hunter, and also a very wise creature. These are some of the hidden images. Some will see these as maybe frightening, others will see curiosity. And I think it's interesting inviting people into that, seeing that body language again. This is really the only image which has aggression in it. And well, when you're in a situation like that, you just have to move away as quick as you can. I have, as I said, I tend not to talk too much about the macho bullshit kind of thing in this. I have been bitten, I have been tested, especially by this large individual. I have been tested. They're skeptical, and as I said, they are like children, so they can use their hierarchy to make a point to the others in the group. They can get hang-ups, just like us, in something, you know, hanging from your hair or your shoelaces. And sometimes it's, when they're in that train of thought or action, it's kind of difficult to get them away from it, and you can't really move. So just to say a little bit something about that, when you do greet them, if they choose to meet you, you are in their territory. So first time and second time also, I felt that I was kind of coming in to survey these animals. The thing is, you have to be on your knees with your mouth open. And the way they greet you is having their tongue quite far into your throat. Yeah, and that's how they get food when they're puppies. Just like birds will peck on each other's, you know, sometimes they have marks even where they peck to get food. So it is a social greeting. I think it's also really to say that you're ours, you know, for the time being. And sometimes they need to be distracted by these two other people. Being dragged to the ground by a wolf is not a good feeling. If you do show weakness, it's not good for the dynamics of the group. They're very sensitive. They're so in tune to nature that if you have a bad immune system, if you're sick, you can't meet them. Not just because they can get sick, but the young ones can be a little bit unsure of the situation. If they see your weakness, you know, they can also jump on you, and the rest of the group will probably follow, and you don't want that. One time I had a bad ankle, and I couldn't be with them because they could also sense that. So I've tried to find postures in the wolf which kind of goes back to a little bit of fairy tales, of the hidden, of the mythical. And this is like almost like a wailing. This is really flirting, but it does look like a wailing song. And here is part of the fear, extreme fear, which we also need to, as I said, to survive. Working in winter is pretty tough. It's actually very difficult to get these images because they are in constant motion, and I'm using quite large equipment. There's no rapid fire digital things going on here, so you really have to have patience. And you really have to give them time. A lot of these images are about trust. Yeah, it's very dark. And they will also recognize everything about you. The smell of you, whatever situation there's been, if you make a weird noise. You know, I was, for some reason I'm talking about this biting, but as an example, I was bitten, well, since I don't have fur, you know, I really do feel that, but it's just their way of communicating. I didn't scream, but I made a sound. And when we came out of this area, the woman, the one that's been introducing me, said that, you know, when you scream like that, like a woman, I'm like, okay, she's a tough girl, fine. When you make noises like that, next time they see you, they're gonna see you as a squeaky toy. And that's not a good situation, because they will just want to make that sound again, just like children. So it's this very bizarre contrast. I have been working with reflections also. They're skeptical to water because they don't know what's underneath. So we can see this wolf as such a tough animal, but they're very, very, very sensitive. But I have also tried to invite the viewer into a little bit of that nature part, that which we also are born as part of in a very big way. So, as I mentioned, looking at the relationship between nature and culture, I've been working on an island for, as you see, for the past 14 years. This island is called Spitsbergen. It's in an archipelago of Svalbard, which is located 78 degrees north between Norway and the North Pole. It's really the last stop before you come to the North Pole. And it's the most northerly community in the world. And I've been spending a long time there, starting out with these amazing technical installations, the visual consequences of man's search. And all of these installations have to do with surveying climate change. This particular image, antenna forest, is used to measure temperature and atmospheric pressure. This series has been shown in many countries, in many museums, and some galleries internationally. And it says a lot about the project, really. It creates its own landscape, and the contrast, the juxtaposition between this technology and the man-made and this primal landscape is, to me, still awe-inspiring. And being on this island is also very special. It is like being on another planet. And there are polar bears around. You have to have a gun with you at all times. You have to have snow scooters, provisions. Sometimes you travel quite long distances, and you're not really protected in any way, which I think feels really good. So this island is known to have the cleanest atmosphere on Earth. And scientists from all over the world come to the island to study climate change, ice, and atmospheric pollution. So it's partly man trying to predict the future of mankind through technology. They also help scientists to survey melting ice sheets, currents, and the vegetation, obviously, through huge antennas. Since the island is more or less on top of the Earth, satellites fly by more frequently than closer to the equator, because there would be this huge rock in the way, the Earth. So I use these photographs as metaphors, exploring the relationship between man, technology, and primal nature. Man and man's creations, our extrovert search for knowledge, and our introvert search for insight. And to me, these are two very different things. Knowledge can be taught. Insight has to be experienced firsthand. And since the beginning of time, man has looked outwardly to find answers, and in our evolution, pushed boundaries into new frontiers. So this is a really cheesy image. It's quite naive, but it is what it is. It's obviously it's the Earth. And the reason I put this in the presentation is that it's the first image captured by man. It's the most downloaded image on the internet, taken by NASA from the first Apollo mission, who were able to see the Earth in this way. And I want to read a small text written by Minik Rosing from the Arctic exhibition, which was at Louisiana Art Museum in Copenhagen just a month ago, while you're looking at this image. In the closing decades of the 20th century, humankind began to see itself and its role in the world in a new light. The recognition that the world was finite and fragile hit us all at once. It is said when NASA published the first photo of the Earth seen from space. The picture taken on December 7th, on their way to the moon, is probably the most seen photo of all time. It shows a small, unfathomably beautiful, but also frighteningly lonely and vulnerable planet in vast, empty, ice-cold space. The picture makes it obvious to everyone that our existence is utterly dependent on the planet's resources and fragile ecological balance. The same technology that made it possible for us to see ourselves from space gave us powers comparable to the forces of nature. And I think that really helps getting a view, and I obviously, in a bigger scheme of things. So the juxtapose between nature and culture is enormous on this island. The installations as a backdrop of an icy otherworldly landscape is very bizarre. This is one of the satellite antennas, and it's 50 meters in diameter. I am using a large format panoramic camera, analog, which isn't the easiest thing in these temperatures and natural surroundings. It's all very manual. And the reason I've had to come back so many times is this can only be done in a certain time of year, in February, March, where the sun still hasn't come up. There's just a glow from the sun, and moonlight takes over very quickly. So this particular image is taken at night on 8-hour exposures. And since it's analog, I also have to get back to the mainland to see these. And it's just very time consuming. And this space, or the time that this takes, really does something to you. There is an ear deafening silence, which I'm not used to, which I really do need. And I'm working with, you have small references in this image as well, from the lights to the ladder, compared to size and time of day. And this particular image is called Winter Night, from the famous painting of Harald Solberg. So let me show you some more images here. I've wanted to focus on different types of structures, not just an antenna forest or a dish. Again, using the perception of the landscape around to try to confuse the viewer somehow. And it's interesting working with this, because coming back to many of the same installations, they're different every time. I mean, it's not just the lights or the landscape, but it is like taking a portrait of a human being, constantly changing. Always very different. I mean, it's impossible to do the same thing again. This is from a tiny community called Ny-Ålesund, which is restricted. The Norwegian Polar Institute has most of this, or has all of the rules here. But there are scientists from all over the world, because this is the supposedly the cleanest atmosphere on Earth. So the Germans have LIDAR rays, which go up into the atmosphere, which is pulses of sound, but it looks like laser beams. the Japanese have installation here. It's a huge joint venture. This image is called Sunken Ship, and it's also for atmospheric tests. This is another very long exposure on over 8 hours. And in the meantime, there's been a huge bank of fog covering this image completely and then going away again. So they really do make up their own personalities. And working like this, you have to partly let go. It is also partly intuitive. You can't measure this light. And it's important to find some kind of reference for the viewer to see proportions and a sense of scale. And I like the idea of the man-made light kind of bleeding off into the landscape. And a lot of the installations are just, how do you call that, bardonnette, like, tied down with wires? What's that?
Guy.
Okay.
The guy wires?
Yes. Anchored, thank you. Okay, I'd like to share the, you know, I work with contrast in all of my series, and I've really been waiting for this to happen as well. I have been working with the Global Seed Vault a few times now. Also, just a very simple shape, but saying really so much about this project. The antennas represent very much the cert outwardly. This represents very much the inner, also fear. It represents a lot of hope, but the fear of what can happen in terms of climate change. So the Global Seed Vault holds already almost 1 million seeds of biodiversity. It's a joint venture between the Norwegian government and NordGen and the Global Crop Diversity Trust. It's open for all countries in the world. North Korea just delivered its seeds. Well, obviously in a different way than everyone else. Usually they're plastic bags in plastic casings. They had everything in wood and hand-painted. So it's quite fun to see. So in this very, very extreme landscape, they've made a deep shaft inside this mountain. And actually, on top of this mountain are some of the antennas that you saw earlier. It's constructed in a way where the angle is supposed to protect us not just from global climate change, but also to protect us from ourselves in terms of nuclear war and also terrorism, which I think is interesting. You know, where did everything go wrong? We are evolving, and technology is also evolving exponentially, but that communication isn't really working too well. So it's a very symbolic entrance, and I like to use it as a very subtle, with a subtle landscape around it. And I think it's nice that they've left it as a concrete block. So these are from earlier trips, and I was let inside after a year of emails and telephones. Here you see some of the bay going into Longyearbyen.
How do you get access to that?
Persuasion, yeah, and luck, I think. So, but they were very helpful when I got in there. And I just want to stress that it is a very including and open bank. I mean, all countries can deposit here. They have to keep it that open, obviously, in the future. So here also the enormous contrast between nature and culture really becomes clear. these are boxes on their way in. This is not the actual seed bank. These are just deposits soon going into the actual vault. And you have these tiny spaces around in the area, which I find interesting. Actually, the least interesting thing were the actual seeds, I think. Which sounds weird, but yeah, I'm interested in these contrasts. And ice particles collect on what they've tried to kind of cover up of mountain. The actual seed vault holds about minus 20 degrees Celsius. It's taken 2 or 3 years to actually freeze down the whole mountain. And the whole idea with this is not just that it's super safe with several vaults, but it's sustainable. It doesn't need electricity. If all else fails, technology, the mountain is so cold in its permafrost, and even colder now after 2-3 years of freezing it down, that it's sustainable for not just tens of years, but maybe even centuries. There are many seed vaults in the world, but if the power runs out, it could take a couple of days before they're too hot and will be destroyed. So this is really a backup of all backups in the world. This is one of the other vault rooms, which is getting ready to receive more. And the actual vault can hold 3 million seeds. And I read the other day that the survey of crop diversity hasn't been really, they haven't really followed it up very much, it seems. So in 100 years, it shows from the new test that crop diversity has fallen by almost 80%. Diversity is one of the most important things we have. And this is the door into the actual vault, where also nature and man meet in this structure in the wall. This is condensation between cinder blocks. And this is all you're going to see of the actual seeds. It's just to the side in the back of the whole vault. And a nice contrast, I think, in preserving a possible future. I find it interesting that, just talking about natural resources, that overpopulation is a bit of a taboo as well. But it has very much to do with the bigger picture. And mega cities are being built, even more in China, and the population in India is getting out of control. And all of those people have rights to electricity, to clean water, to all of what we have as well. So the question would obviously be, how much more it can take, how much more the planet can take. The UN had recently a huge summary with scientists on climatic changes. And I think they concluded with that we have a small window of being able to change all that we've been able to do. And I hope this series also can remind us that we are also a species. We can also go extinct. The planet would, I'm sure, do really well without us. And just looking at different possibilities and how to turn things around, looking at man's ego, and trying to remind people that we are also nature. We are born as something much larger than ourselves. And hopefully through this work, bring some awareness to that issue. So the question, the last question would be, if nature ultimately is with us or against us. And that's really my presentation. I'd love to show you lots more, but that would have to be next time.